documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
We're just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, along with Vicki Davis. Nice to have you with us once again here on this 5th of August, 2017. As the months of summer are rapidly slipping away, and it's good to have you with us once again, ladies and gentlemen. It's turned off just absolutely beautiful here in southern Michigan. The leaves are starting to turn, believe it or not, already on some of the trees. Not a lot of them yet, but a few of them. It's pretty amazing to see that happen this early in the year. But it's not unprecedented. We've seen this before. I don't know. Some of it might be because we've had a lot of dry weather lately. But it's nevertheless, it's turned off cool. We slept with the windows open last night for the first time in a long time. And it's just absolutely beautiful to be able to turn off the air conditioner and give the air conditioner a little rest. And be able to sleep comfortably with the windows open and that night air coming in. I love Michigan. I'll tell you, there's no place like home. And it's the change of seasons, I think, that I love the most. I don't like the winters so much, but I do like it when the weather starts to turn. And there's, I don't know, it's just a feeling in the air that just kind of, unless you live in the north, or you have, you don't understand it probably, but anyway, welcome to Govern America, ladies and gentlemen. A lot of things going on. Vicki Davis, I believe, is standing by. Vicki, good morning.
Good morning, Darren.
Hey, there you are. Loud and clear.
I'm getting a feedback.
You are? From yourself?
I don't think so. Okay. Nope, I'm plugged in.
Okay. Sheesh. I hate that when that happens.
Yeah, me too.
Are you hearing you, or are you hearing me?
I'm hearing me.
Hmm.
It's feeding back to me.
That's strange, because nothing's really changed here. Well, if worse comes to worse, I'll put you on this other Skype machine here. Go ahead, keep talking.
Okay. There. Now I'm gone.
Now
good.
Gone.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. Hopefully I haven't cut you off from something else. I'm hesitant to make changes on the fly because then later on somebody might not hear you. All right. So anyway, anything going on special in your neck of the woods?
Not so much. No, it's been pretty quiet here, but a lot of interesting things going on at the national level.
Oh, always. One thing.
This whole thing about Trump being surrounded by all these generals, mm-hmm. That's pretty unnerving.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Before we get too deeply into the program, I did want to point this out here. We've lost another Patriot warrior. I don't know if you've heard this or not, but Jim Mars has passed away.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
The Star-Telegram says Jim Mars, the author whose book Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy, helped inspire the Oliver Stone movie JFK, died of a heart attack Wednesday at his Wise County home. He was 73. He worked as a Star-Telegram reporter between 1968 and 1980. Didn't just write about JFK. He authored books about everything from UFOs to population control. He taught courses on JFK assassination and UFOs at the University of Texas at Arlington before retiring in 2007. In a 2003 Star-Telegram article, Mars said lawyers, teachers, and even an official with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had taken his classes. So anyway, I won't get too far into that, but I just wanted to pass that along to people. I found out about it earlier in the week on Twitter. Thank you to the folks on Twitter for letting me know.
Is he the one that wrote Rise of the Fourth Reich?
I'm not sure.
Okay. I get confused between Tex Mars and Jim Mars.
Yeah, and I just had a discussion about this the other day because we were trying to figure out whether or not they were related, and I don't think that they are. I think it's just a coincidence that they have the same last name. But anyway, I always hate to see people who have done a lot and have been out there for many, many years. You know, have you know they, their time when their time comes, because it's just we're indebted to the truth seekers. Anybody who's paying attention and trying to get the message out, regardless of what the subject is. So.
Yeah. And it's years and years and years of research lost when they die. Right. Even if it's written down, you can't write everything you know. It just, it's not possible.
Well, it's like Gerner, you know, Chris Gerner used to say, there's nobody there to replace them. I mean, and I would like to think that that's not true, because I do know that there's a lot of up-and-coming researchers who are working to get up to speed. A lot of people have awakened. A lot of people are in the process of awakening, and really all of us have our own awakening process. And it is a process. And but minds that are already up to speed is what we need to tackle the problems that we face. And he was certainly one of those. So anyway, Jim Mars, rest in peace. There's other things going on. I don't know if you heard about this DEF CON conference.
Yeah, that's the one with the guy that was on C-SPAN, right? Talking about the, what are they, the black hats?
Yes.
And yeah, and, very interesting.
And they attacked, and I put the word in quotes, they attacked the voting machines. And I thought this is kind of interesting because we've been talking about voting machines for many years. We've been talking about the vulnerabilities that exist, but also the fact that we can't really know what these things are really doing. What are the code? What is the code actually doing inside the machine? Now, that's the aspect that's still not really being talked about, is are the machines designed to flip the vote? I think that they are. And the courts have ruled that the code is proprietary. We're not allowed to see it. But for the first time, and the problem with not being able to see the code, aside from the fact that you don't know if the code itself is malicious, you don't know if it's designed to be malicious and to rig the vote. But
well, and probably what you know most people don't know is that the code can be patched after it's already in the machine. I mean, you know, when you write code and then you compile it and it's in machine code, it can still be modified.
Right. Yeah, and well, I mean, that's how your operating system is patched. That's how most software is patched. You download an update, and it fixes whatever vulnerability is there. The problem here is that is a big security breach, a big security problem when ordinary researchers aren't allowed to get in and crack things. There was just a story that I was listening to Security Now with Steve Gibson, which is a podcast. I never miss it because the information he covers is very critical to those of us who have websites, who operate on the internet. You just have to know everything that's going on, and he's kind of very good at compiling all this stuff that I don't have time to look at. But he was just mentioning that there was a security researcher that had gotten into somebody's website and hacked in because they just pretty much had this company was the security was laughable. It was a joke, and I think it was some kind of transportation system. Now that I think about it, and he managed to purchase a ticket. Actually, I think he got at a very reduced price. I forget the exact numbers, but he was able, but simply changing the URL, I think, in the address bar or something ridiculous like that, that passed the information on to the server. And he did it just to see if he could do it. And once he found out he could do it, now he didn't use the ticket, and he immediately responsibly notified them that they had a problem. What do? They contact the authorities. Next thing you know, he knows, they're knocking on his door, and they've got him in cuffs. He's being prosecuted for hacking into this security company's or this transportation company's website and purchasing a ticket when he's doing this as a researcher.
Yeah, well, and you know what? People that are programmers, when they, if they find any kind of vulnerability, they'll usually pursue it, debugging it.
Yes.
I mean, I did that myself, not to buy anything, but there was a problem with the Washington Post website. And a story that had been there.
Well, there's a lot of problems with the Washington Post website. But
somebody scrambled the index just on a few stories that happened to be very, very revealing during the Katrina debacle. And I actually debugged it, and I sent them a message about it, and I gave them screen prints of everything I did. You know, but I suppose they could have. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know, that you would punish a person who is trying to help you out.
Well, what it's going to do is it's going, if this happens a lot, what it'll do is it'll have a chilling effect on anybody doing any kind of security research whatsoever, because people will not report things that they find. And that is exactly the opposite of what you want. You want people to be poking at things and people to be trying to get in. I mean, good people, because you know the bad people are going to be doing that. So when the good people find those things and responsibly disclose them to you, that is a gift. That is a blessing.
Gift. It's an absolute gift, because they're using their talents and skills. You know, if you'd hired a consultant. But they're giving you the gift for free. So
in some cases, yeah. and there are those companies that do, you know, the major companies recognize the importance of this, and they offer bounties, rewards, and the harder it is to find security flaws, the greater the rewards they have to offer to motivate people to poke at it. But yeah. You know, that's how security flaws are discovered. But the last thing you want is people are being prosecuted for finding these things. So, anyway, I digress. The point is, though, is that for the first time, these hackers were turned loose on some the major voting systems, and every single one of them was successfully hacked.
Yeah.
The USA Today was reporting on this. They said, hackers, 5, voting machines, 0. It took less than a day for attendees at the DEF CON hacking conference to find and exploit vulnerabilities in 5 different voting machine types. The first ones were discovered within an hour and 30 minutes, and none of these vulnerabilities has ever been found before. They're all new. Well, that's because they haven't been looked at before. One group even managed to rickroll a touchscreen voting machine, getting it to run Rick Astley's song, Never Gonna Give You Up, from 1987. The Voting Machine Hacking Village event at the 25th Annual DEF CON Computer Security Conference ran from Friday to Sunday. Its goal was to educate the computer security community about potential weaknesses of the voting machine used in U.S. elections and get them involved in fixing them. By all accounts, it worked. So let's just hope. See, I'm not very optimistic that these things are going to be made more secure. And the problem is that, again, as I said earlier, we don't know. There's no way to know.
Yeah, they can't make them secure. They just simply cannot make them secure. If they use computers, it should just be for printing out a paper ballot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're really good for people that are disabled, you know, because they have the accessibility features. But the minority.
Accessibility can be, you know what? The accessibility features, it's called Braille. Now, I don't know how many blind people, I don't know if there's, I hear that they're not even still teaching Braille in the schools for the blind.
Yeah, but that's expensive, though, to do that.
Well, yeah, but so are voting machines. You know? I mean...
Well, yeah.
But the problem is you'd have...
become obsolete in a few years, too.
Yeah, and Braille never does as long as it's still being taught. Hey, we got a call on the line. Let me go ahead and take the call here. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Yeah, this is Ken from West Virginia.
Hey, Ken.
And you're talking about hackers. It's not really news in the United States. Well, it is, but, I mean, I've been following Sky News out of England, and they had that WannaCry virus that hit the NHS, the National Health Service over there a couple months ago. And there was some guy that came out, and anyway, he tipped them off. It was a kill switch. And anyway, he's just been arrested. There's a thing called DEFCON or something out in Vegas.
Yeah, that's what we were just talking about.
And he's just been arrested, accused of being a hacker. And so his name is Marcus Hutchins, MarcusHutchins, you know, and it's all very technical and way beyond me as far as, but, you know, but anyway, it's kind of interesting, you know, that you're talking about. He's a good guy, and now the FBI's got him, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like another example of what we were just talking about. Here's a guy who is a security researcher. And let's see, I just found an NBC News article. As a vast ransomware attack raced from computer to computer, infecting tens of thousands around the world, a young tech expert worked from his bedroom in England to bring the rampage to a halt. Is this the guy that registered the domain name that we were talking about?
I don't know. I think it's probably two different people. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't. Might be the same person.
Hmm.
It doesn't say anything about that in here.
Okay.
It just says he was. He was in Vegas and living. He was driving a Lamborghini and everything, living in a $5 million mansion and everything. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So God knows what he. And they think he was going. You know, hacking into bank accounts or something. You know, I don't know.
Okay, I'll have to do some more research on it. I don't know.
Yeah, Marcus Hutchins, MarcusHutchins.
Because I know that there was one guy who they included some kind of kill switch inside that program. I think it was WannaCry that I'm referring to, and it was an inadvertent thing. I don't think it was even intentional. At the time we talked about it, I was thinking it was intentional. It was actually something that they just, it was a way for the, what it did is it contacted a domain name that wasn't really registered. And somebody discovered that and just registered the domain name to make it quit. Because as long as the domain name was registered, then it wouldn't be able to phone home, and that's somehow how it did its thing, is by contacting this insane domain name that would have been very unlikely for anybody to ever register. And so somebody looking at the code discovered how it worked and said, well, shoot, I'll just register the domain name. And they registered it.
That may be the same guy. That could be the same guy. And what I'm thinking now is that you know, they've got pictures of him here in the Daily Mail, and he's out there living it up. And I'm kind of thinking that he may have been actually the one that created, and then created the, and then came out and came up with a kill switch, and you know what I'm saying? And probably was he probably may possibly participated in doing it, and then I think they did collect several hundred thousand dollars or something.
Yeah. Okay. Here it says. Hutchins, who works for Los Angeles-based CryptoLogic, said late Monday that hundreds of computer experts worked throughout the weekend to fight the virus, which paralyzed computers in some 150 countries. I'm definitely not a hero, he said. I'm just someone doing my bit to stop botnets. In the first hours after the virus struck Friday, and this, I'll have to go back up to see what the date of this article is, they said the computer whiz and surfing enthusiast in a small seaside town in southwest England discovered a so-called kill switch that slowed the unprecedented outbreak. He then spent the next 3 days fighting the worm that crippled Britain's hospital network as well as factories, government agencies, banks, and other businesses around the world. WannaCry paralyzed computers running mostly older versions of Microsoft Windows by encrypting users' computer files and displaying a message demanding a ransom of $300 to $500 to release them. Failure to pay would leave the data mangled and likely beyond repair. Yeah, here it is. Hutchins said he stumbled across the solution when he was analyzing a sample of the malicious code and noticed it was linked to an unregistered web address. He promptly registered the domain, something he regularly does to discover ways to track or stop cyber threats, and found that stopped the worm from spreading. So you're telling me now that they're prosecuting him for this?
Well, I just sent you a link to a Daily Mail. They're claiming that he was involved in something in Vegas where some other activity. In other words, he was being a good guy in this WannaCry, but he was involved in something nefarious and some other something else.
Okay.
So then they're claiming I sent you the Daily Mail article and says, well, was he set up? And
interesting.
It could be the possibility that he did the crime, and then he became the hero, like a fireman will start the fire and then become the hero. You know.
Yeah, or it could be that they wanted this virus to encrypt, to wreak havoc and cause a lot of problems, and this guy got in the way. I'm smelling a rat here, man. But I guess, see, that's my conspiratorial mind, Kent.
Yeah, well, you know, he's out in Vegas. He was out in Vegas and driving around in a Lamborghini and living in a posh mansion or something for this convention. So, you know, he was living, you know, of course, those guys make big salaries,
yeah.
You know, so I guess
yeah.
Maybe he's...
That's not necessarily proof that he's no good. I don't know. I try to give people the benefit of a doubt, you know, especially in light of controlled chaos that we have being engineered around us all the time. But anyway.
I'll let you go. I just wanted to. I've been following that in the.
Yeah, I appreciate you pointing that out. That'll be interesting. We'll have to look deeper into that.
All right, well, thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Talk to you later. Kent in West Virginia, ladies and gentlemen. So regarding this hacking thing, let me just do this. Lee Camp has got a show on RT, and he kind of took kind of a humorous look at this hacking convention, this DEF CON thing.
So I have new evidence that our voting system on a scale of 1 to 10, our voting system is a pile of garbage. Just a heaping, festering, stink lines coming off of it. Pile of garbage. Okay, there's this hacking convention in Vegas called DEF CON. Okay, and they had the hacking convention, and they had what they called the voting village. They had a room that was just voting machines of various kinds. Because a lot of states, you know, states, cities, they have different kinds of voting machines. So they had a bunch of these in all electronic voting machines in this room. And they let hackers come in and they said, do what you will. Let's see how hard it is for you, king of the nerd kingdom, the hacking nerd kingdom. Can you get into these machines? Okay, now I don't know how this... I don't know any of this shit's done. I don't know anything about hacking. I don't know anything about code. But I will tell you this. They hacked them all. They got into just about all of them. Okay? They tore them up. They tore up these machines. A lot of them took not even that much time. 90 minutes or so. A lot of them. One of the machines, they even Rickrolled. They Rickrolled the fucking machine. Never gonna give you up. Never gonna let you down. You know that thing? They made the machine do that. That is for a voting machine, that is the equivalent of wiping your ass with it. All right, the WinVote machine, which is another type of software on some of these machines, it was used in Virginia from 2003 to 2015 when it was finally decertified. The encryption key that they were able to break to get in to this WinVote machine that was used for years and other places, the encryption key was... Hold on, I wrote it down here. They were able to guess this out of thin air. They figured this out. The encryption key was A, B, C, D, E. Somehow, I don't know how these hackers did it. They were able to get in. A, B, C, D, E.
So these guys with this electronic poll book have already gotten access to the database.
We can add fake voters, subtract voters from the voter record, vote multiple times.
They own the database.
Thank you, VMware. Good job.
Okay, now you're starting to understand just how incredibly hackable our voting machines are. Very, very hackable. Now, most of them, you have to be in the room, okay? They're not connected. Most of them are not connected to the internet. So most of this is done in the room. It's done with the pieces. It's done by touching the hardware. It's done with USB ports. One of the biggest things you can do on a voting machine is just create chaos in the voting booth. If you can just make things confusing and f***ed up, then people don't get to vote. Now, this is how our system was hacked in the primaries by Hillary and the DNC, right? Phoenix, Arizona, they closed something like 70% of the polling places, so people are waiting in line for hours on end, so they just go home. So that's another way to hack our system. You just create chaos. You just close voting places. In Brooklyn, New York, 100,000 people knocked off the polls in the primaries, right? 100,000, mainly Bernie voters, knocked off the polls. You can go read headlines. You can read articles about it right now. They're still up. Go read them. 100,000 people knocked off the polls. So not only does that knock that 100,000 off the polls, but people are in line. They're saying, what do you mean I'm not signed up to vote? It creates chaos in the voting places. And then people don't get to vote. Our system is incredibly hackable. So maybe you're asking, well, if our system is so hackable, why has it never happened in the past that our votes, our elections have been hacked? They have!
So he goes on to provide examples of how that, you know, how it's been hacked in different places. But I thought that was interesting. We're getting down to the point where now this is going a little bit more mainstream. And the question we all need to be asking ourselves is, why now? Why now? We'll be back. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. GovernAmerica.com is the website for the radio program. GovernAmerica.com. My email address is radio@governamerica.com. And Vicki, go ahead and give your website information out.
Okay, my website, my old website that has probably most of my research is channelingreality.com. And my new website is thetechnocratictyranny.com. And I sometimes write for TVOINews.net. And my email address is eyeswideoopen@channelingreality.com.
All right. And
well, you almost have to reserve a segment to say all that.
Well, it's important information because people need to know where to find you. And so anyway, moving along here, I see the war drums are beating. We're having more and more rhetoric all the time. Last week we were talking about North Korea and how it's being trumpeted up as being a major threat. There is one thing I wanted to say in the area of clarification or correction. We were talking about the missile defense system last week, and I somewhat tongue-in-cheek mentioned that, because you said if North Korea really is a big threat with the ICBMs, that I want all my money back from those years of research that we were supposedly developing a missile defense system. And I somewhat tongue-in-cheek said, yeah, they don't really have the technology. But, you know, I wanted to clarify because I did, you know, they do claim to have technology that does that. And in fact, they tested it last weekend and shot down a couple of missiles that were, they said, medium-range missiles. So they are supposed to have the technology, and I guess there's a government agency that is involved in determining, you know, in other words, running this program. But it really begs the question, if this technology is as good as they claim it is, if it really does exist and it's as good as they claim it is, then why the big cry over North Korea? Why the big worry over missiles that could, you know, why the hysteria, I guess, is the question I'm asking. Now, I don't know, you know, if they were running a nuke on a missile, it was headed for the United States, and we blew it up in the sky. In other words, our missile defense system, THAAD, I guess is what it's called, intercepted this thing. What would be the fallout, I guess, from a nuclear explosion in the air?
I don't know. Are those missiles there? I doubt his test missiles are armed.
No, I don't think they have a payload as far as nuclear is concerned. I don't think he, you know, with the type of technology. I mean, he doesn't have the kind of nukes we have.
Right. Well, you know what they do in this age of the technocratic tyranny? They're playing off people's scientific ignorance is what they're doing. Mm-hmm. That's with climate change, with the endangered species, with everything. They are using science as a kind of a propaganda weapon against people, and most people won't challenge authority. Mm-hmm. Somebody that they think is an authority, they won't challenge them. And so they use this bogus science, fake science, and they use it as a political tool to do something that they want to do anyway. I mean,
yeah. Well, they do the same thing with regard to not just science, but everything. I mean, political, anything political. But they play upon people's fears. And the one thing everyone fears is the unknown. The one thing
everyone... Yeah, fears and ignorance. That's exactly right.
And, I mean, it's the most base emotions that there are, and that is what they use. But the idea is... you talk to the average American on the street that doesn't know anything about it, and they say, yeah, take them out. But there's a whole geopolitical thing that happens once you start into that arena. And, you know, I'm reminded, because we were also talking last week about how North Korea got nuclear weapons. I mentioned Rumsfeld's ABB company that he sat in front of as a CEO of, and they were selling nuclear reactors to North Korea at the time, right about the time, I think it was the same year that Rumsfeld and others, the other neocons, were proclaiming North Korea to be part of the axis of evil and that, you know, we need a regime change. And they mentioned that in the Project for a New America Century report, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Now, the truth of the matter is, North Korea was already on its way to having nuclear, being a nuclear power before that. As a matter of fact, you mentioned last week, Vicky, Bill Clinton's involvement in trying to broker a deal with North Korea to stop them from developing a nuclear weapon. They were already working to develop a nuclear weapon even before North Korea or even before Bill Clinton did that deal. Now, some are claiming that that paved the way for, you know, North Korea to have a nuke. I don't know that that's the case.
Well, they need, in order to justify going in and taking a leader out, mm-hmm. and replacing him with a technocratic manager, they need an excuse. And WMD is the excuse and has been ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany. Mm-hmm. In this country, the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Act. And what that was is They decided to help the Soviet Union dispose of, well, not just dispose of their weapons system, but also to give them aid to, you know, during their crisis, the crisis of the coup d'etat, the alleged coup d'etat that was tried to be executed against Gorbachev. But that is the excuse and has been the excuse since that legislation was passed, I believe, in 1994. But there was a piece of legislation that was passed in 1992 before that, mm-hmm. to bring all of the Soviet scientists over here and employ them so that they would not sell their knowledge to bad actors, quote unquote. And so, so they have to, in order to justify going into some country, there has to be a threat of WMD.
Yeah, weapons of mass destruction.
Yes,
and here we have this deal that was brokered by Bill Clinton back in 1994. As a matter of fact, I got the audio here. Let me just. This is Bill Clinton talking about the, you know, the glowing things about this agreement and how everybody was just going to join hands and sing kumbaya.
Before I take your questions, I'd like to say just a word about the framework with North Korea that Ambassador Gallucci signed this morning. This is a good deal for the United States. North Korea will freeze and then dismantle its nuclear program. South Korea and our other allies will be better protected. The entire world will be safer as we slow the spread of nuclear weapons. South Korea, with support from Japan and other nations, will bear most of the cost of providing North Korea with fuel to make up for the nuclear energy it is losing. And they will pay for an alternative power system for North Korea that will allow them to produce electricity while making it much harder for them to produce nuclear weapons. The United States and international inspectors will carefully monitor North Korea to make sure it keeps its commitments. Only as it does so will North Korea fully join the community of nations.
Now, once again, that was Bill Clinton back in 1994 talking about this in glowing terms about this agreement that they inked with North Korea. Now, if you look at and see how everything he says did not materialize the way he said it was going to happen, and then we think back about to the Obama administration more recently and the deal that he inked with Iran, and all of a sudden, you know, I mean, we gave North Korea billions of dollars in energy assets, for lack of a better way of putting it, to substitute their nuclear reactors that they had with other forms of energy. And there were some reactors.
Gave them windmills?
Well, the oil is one of the things that they were burning. And I'm trying to remember what I was reading about it. But some of it was oil, heating oil. And the part of the problem, too, is that we started reneging on the deal just as soon as we made the deal. And so it's complicated. But the problem is we don't keep our end of the bargain either. And so they, out of frustration, they continue to work on their nuclear program. And I'm not trying to, you know, take sides here and side with North Korea or side with any foreign policy power over the United States. I'm trying to look at things objectively. And often is the case, the United States either drops the ball or screws people over. And if we're going to look at it objectively, we have to say it that way.
Well, the that Nunn-Lugar led cooperative threat reduction, that's really important to understand the whole global technocratic strategy, because that was when they developed the global freight tracking system, and it was to track the nuclear materials point to point and chain of custody. And so, you know, that's when it was built, and that's when they started building the highway systems that have the tracking technology embedded in the infrastructure. And that technology, the development of that technology, actually started in Germany before the end of the Cold War, before the Berlin Wall came down. And and then, of course, it came over here in 1990 with the announcement of the new paradigm in transportation. And the plans were for fully technologically enabled transportation systems and transportation hubs and so forth. Mm-hmm. They're called intermodal commerce zones. But what it is, on one level, it is technology for the highway systems. On a lower level, it is technology for the police state, because it is for total domain awareness, tracking all movement. And if you look at it from a military perspective, it is total domain awareness of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same technology. It just has a different front end on it for the military than it does, you know, in domestic use.
Yeah.
But it's the same system.
And this is all laid out in your latest work, which is up on thetechnocratictyranny.com. Let's see, I'm trying to find the...
Well, I've been trying to put together the history of the NAFTA superhighway. And that's when I did that history, I found the European piece. And Japan had a piece of it. Germany and Japan actually started the technology project for the highways, which is a very interesting tidbit when you consider that it corresponds to the ending of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, of course, Germany and Japan were allies against the Western powers in World War II.
Right. Yeah, the unholy alliances for the New World Order is what it, is what your latest thing is called. TheTechnocraticTyranny.com. If you go there and read that, that is an excellent piece that Vicky has written just in the last few days. I don't know how you may have been working on it longer than a few days, however, judging by what's there.
I did that actually on my old website, and I just moved the... I did a story called 1991, The Year the World Changed, because in my earlier research, I kept running into the year 1991 as being as major things happening. And this, the highway system, the technology-laden highway system, was one of those things. And what I found out was that the U.S. Department of Justice and the military had signed a memorandum of understanding for joint development of technologies.
Mm-hmm.
on things other than war and other than law enforcement. So you have to ask yourself, well, if it's technology for other than war and other than law enforcement, then what is the Department of Justice component of this
thing?
What
are they doing?
Ultimately, it is the fusion center. So you've got the military partnered with the Department of Justice to build the ultimate police state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's everything's being weaponized against us.
That's absolutely what, everything.
And the highways are being weaponized against us. I mean, your right to travel is being curtailed, but even more than that, as you travel, you will be tracked. It's kind of like a, you know, when somebody releases, when they release a prisoner from imprisonment, when they release an inmate from imprisonment, and they want to keep track of where they go everywhere, they put an ankle bracelet on them. And it's kind of like the entire population is being forced to wear ankle bracelets. Not literal ankle bracelets, but when you go down the road, and every time, you know, everywhere you go, you see cameras on the highways. You've got tracking chips and everything. You've got smartphones and smart everything. To the point where, I mean, Ron even sent me a story. Get a load of this.
The newest trend in smart devices is a smart water bottle. I've been talking to Dave about this one over the last couple days. In the same way that you use a Fitbit to track your steps or monitor your heart rate, smart water bottles like these from Hydrate Spark allow you to track your daily water intake. Most of the bottles come with a downloadable app that sends you reminders to drink water throughout the day. The app automatically updates every time you take a sip, making it easy to stay hydrated and keep track of how much water you're drinking. Now, my argument is just remember how much you've had to drink, or maybe set an alarm on your phone, or if you feel thirsty, take a drink. But I just got to let this one
say,
go.
You need to drink more. I know I do.
Right.
It would help, I think.
Okay, so I'll get out of that. But the point is that why do we need this garbage?
We don't. And that's the interesting thing about all this app development. Who's paying to develop these apps? You know,
I think that a lot of the developers just get an idea and they just go with it, thinking that there might be a demand for what they produce, and people buy them if they are interested in them. Mm-hmm. But smart water bottles, I mean, this
you're
is
buying something that is a spy on yourself.
Yeah, and the problem is people don't see it that way yet.
Yet. Well, by the time, you know, one more generation goes by, people are going to be so dumb because they're not educated. They're not educating people, so they won't, you know.
Well, there's really no excuse, though, because people can actually educate themselves if they have the motivation to do so. I don't know. I think what you're talking about here with the all of the smart highway systems, the unholy alliances for the New World Order, you know, the weaponization of highway systems, I think it would be a good place to kind of explore some of the stuff that happened at the World Economic Forum. Because they had segments on self-driving and autonomous cars, and I've been holding on to this stuff for a while. Carlos Ghosn is with the Renault-Nissan Alliance, and he gave a bird's-eye view of where we are with this technology.
Well, first, we need to make a distinction between autonomous cars and driverless cars. Okay, there are two different things, and there is a lot of confusion in the articles. People think autonomous are driverless. It's not. Autonomous car, the driver is in the car, and he decides whenever he wants to drive, whenever he doesn't want to drive. Okay, so it's about empowering the driver. You give him the opportunity to say, you can do whatever you want. Okay, this is now. This is coming now.
I want to pause it for a moment. He says it's about empowering the driver, and yet they're taking away the controls from the drivers. Many of these cars, the prototypes, don't even have controls for the drivers.
Well, I mean, the industry's working on...
Hold on. Sorry about that.
Just to give you some steps.
The industry's working on 5G and 5...
Boy, I'm having a technology meltdown here today.
Just to... Yeah. Give you some steps. One-lane highway autonomy, it's already there. It's offered on a lot of cars. I can give you the example of Nissan. It's on a minivan sold in Japan today. 60% of the people are taking this option, and they are paying for this option. So it's strong. There is a demand from the consumer. 2018, you're going to go on multi-lane highway autonomy. 2020, you're going to have an autonomy city driving, which is the most complicated case. Okay? Then you have the driverless cars. A driverless car is a car without a driver. Obviously, commercial use, robot taxi, Uber, etc. There is a lot of interest on this. And here, it's going to take a little bit more time. And here we're talking about more 2021, 2022. Now, I'm talking about mass marketing. And I'm not talking about having a prototype working somewhere or having a fleet of 500 cars. This is already there. I have driven in Palo Alto, you know, 2 weeks ago, a driving autonomous car in a Nissan car. We have a prototype that's working very well, but we know that between the prototype working well and the mass marketing, it's going to take 2 to 3 years, because you need the thing to work 100%. You need to take in consideration a lot of cases where it's difficult to make a decision, and also you need to wait for the regulator to allow you to put these kind of functions into the car.
Okay, good. We'll get into that. I just want to emphasize one thing you said, which is the consumers, using the Tokyo example, you have a minivan on the market that can drive in a single lane without the driver interaction. Consumers really want it. The World Economic Forum did a study saying that people are willing to pay as much as $5,000 extra. Yeah. That your experience?
Yeah, it's our experience. First, he's very interested. We have a lot of feedbacks about this technology. But the first reaction is comfort and less stress. Okay? Well, it's until you experiment this technology, you don't see the difference between driving with your hands on the wheel, eyes on the road, paying attention to everything, and driving without having to intervene into the car. There's a big difference in terms of stress, particularly, let's not forget, people spend, in average on the planet, 2 hours in the car a day. 2 hours a day. In the United States, it's a little bit less, it's 1 hour. But this is an important element. On top of this, you need to take in consideration the fact that it's much safer. 90% of the accidents on the road are due to human error. So the more you put autonomous drive, the more you have driverless cars, the more you're going to reduce these accidents.
Okay, now I take exception to that statistic that he says a moment ago. 90% of the accidents are the result of the consumer.
Yeah.
These are not on the road in a wide scale basis yet, number one. When they are, I think then you're going to be able to be in a better arena to measure statistics and how dangerous these things actually are.
And I take exception to his statement that the consumers really want these things. If they're taking surveys in Silicon Valley, yeah, they probably really want them, because they're going to make a lot of money, you know, when their technology is embedded in the cars.
The guy's living in a bubble.
Well, he's living in a techno bubble. That's good.
Yeah.
But I don't ever want any technology like that in my car.
No, me either.
I like cruise control, but I want absolute total control.
I
want to
be in control. Exactly. We're at the top of the hour. Hour number two is straight ahead. We'll continue this on the other side. Stay with us.
Crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5, this is our number two of Govern America. It continues to be the 5th of August, 2017, and we're here every Saturday. We hope you'll spread the message about the broadcast here. We're talking about the World Economic Forum's session on self-driving and autonomous cars, in light of the fact that Vicky wrote a piece about smart highway systems. Thought this would be a good time to plug this in, and they're really ratcheting this technology up and pushing it in a big way, claiming that people want it, and I think we're opening a formidable can of worms, and like every technology, once an industry is built around it, as this one already is, putting the genie back into the bottle is almost impossible.
You just made me think of something. I wonder if they are going to guarantee their technology that if it fails, they will pay for the accident, or,
you know. It's funny that you mentioned that, because they addressed that in here somewhere. Mm-hmm. I remember that they said something about this. Now, Paul Jacobs is executive chairman at Qualcomm. This is another smart car industrial complex company. His company is working on the smart highways, roadways, and other infrastructure systems. He was asked about the timelines.
Well, I mean, the industry is working on 5G, and 5G is all about mission critical, high reliability, very low latency.
Yeah, you thought that 5G was all about watching movies real fast.
He means like I do something, and when I get the response, and you can imagine that that's going to be very important. If the cars are talking to each other, and there's a car up ahead that stops, and they're following each other, kind of platoon. For aerodynamic reasons, you don't want the one to stop and the other one not to find out about it too late, right? So that's what one of the things that's coming, and that's 2020 time frame. Right now, you know, we're looking at platforms that come out of the smartphone space. We've got machine intelligence in there. We've got computer vision in there. We've got all of this sensor integration, and we're doing things where when we allow that kind of capability in the car to talk to not just the cloud, because that's a little slower to go to the cloud, but to infrastructure in the city, I think that's where we're going to really see some benefits relative to deaths. I mean, there's 13 pedestrian casualties a day in the United States, and we're going to fix those.
Where'd
kinds
you go,
of...
Darren? Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
It sounds like we lost Darren, or maybe we lost me. I'm not sure.
Well, I hear you. Let me disconnect. Once in a while, Skype does that. It's kind of weird. Hopefully, we're still on the air.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I sure can.
Okay, well, I don't know. You know, once in a while, Skype gets flaky like that. I don't know why that happened. Strange. Anyway.
Things as well. It's not necessarily autonomy, but it's in the car, talking to the smartphone, to the people that are around, because the car knows that it's coming up too fast to a red light or something like that.
As you know, there's a phrase in Silicon Valley about the minimally viable product. You know, you put something out there quickly and then you iterate. That's not a good approach for this technology.
Personally, I hate that idea. I mean, I think the whole notion of beta testing mission-critical software on your customers is probably not a good one. And we've even seen that happen. You know, after the Tesla decapitation accident, the guy gets up and says, oh, well, the feature was coming in the next release that allowed the car to detect a truck coming across. In my mind, that's not a product. So we can't do that as an industry. I've already been through a number of cases where technology...
What's that?
I said, it made me laugh, but it's not funny. I mean, you know.
Oh, the safety feature. Oh, you know... So they're supposed to brake when the car in front of you stops.
Well, and just throwing it out on the market. I mean, that really is the modus operandi of programmers today.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been ever since Microsoft put the first version of Windows out on the market. They put it out there and let their customers test it and report the bugs back.
Yeah, except that this is kind of like a higher stakes game.
Yeah, it is.
Just a little bit.
It got rolled out, and it disappointed the customers in one way or another. So we need to be sure that we don't ruin the customer's expectation and set the whole industry back 10 years by doing that as well.
You know, I'm reminded of the guy that was watching a movie in the back of his self-driving car, and he was killed when his car went underneath a semi-tractor trailer and literally took off the entire top of the car and his head.
Yeah, that's what they mentioned in that clip. There was the decapitation episode.
Yeah. Okay, that one slipped by me. So, anyway, trying to avoid spoiling the experience. And I don't know. I think the best thing, the public had better really get in opposition to this real quick. But I don't know that there's any stopping it, because they're these Silicon Valley types and the CEOs of these companies, the shareholders of these companies, I mean, they're going to demand it. And they've got a lot of clout. And they've created the problem with smartphones and everything and people being distracted, not being able to put these highly addictive systems down. And now they're using that to build the new control mechanism, which is this whole smart infrastructure and smart highway systems. It's
a police state. I mean, you know, that's all you can say about it. It is the ultimate police state, because everything around you, everything you do in life all the information about you will be recorded and instantly accessible, and you'll just be like an animal in the zoo.
Yeah. Violeta Bock is the European Mobility and Transport Commissioner.
There is a lot of things happening at the same time. Mobility is being pretty shaken up with many different trends. First of all, decarbonization. We have a lot of changes now happening because we really want to decrease this, all the impact on the nature, and transport is one of the biggest polluters, especially road transport. So here it's a big push for alternative sources of energy and new propulsion systems, new technologies that will really enable this. So this is one track. The other track is that digitalization is now offering all these incredible functionalities that not only make the drive more fun, but as colleagues already pointed out, really addresses the safety issues, which is related to connected vehicles, cooperative vehicles, autonomous vehicles, and then, of course, driverless vehicles. So these are there's lots of concepts. At the end, somebody has to pay for it. So there has to be a consumer who is willing to pay into all these changes. Statistics also show that people change the car 7 to 10 years cycle. So if we take that into account, I don't know how these figures that we hear from the industry could be really met.
Yeah.
So they've already priced cars just about out of sight, you know, so that the average person can't. Everybody, just about everybody, has to lease cars unless they're wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the thing is that they can. What they can do with these cars too is that, say there is some kind of natural disaster or something, they can shut you down so you can't go anywhere, and you might want to go get your kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They can shut them down remotely, so you can't move.
And don't think that they won't. You know, that's an interesting thought too, because I remember we were talking about a few years back about how the officials and certain, you know, Devil Patrick and you know, the mayor of what was it? What was the name of the town? I forget now. I'm drawing a blank. But one of the mayors. In fact, different mayors have declared states of emergency and ordered people to shelter in place and not come out when there's been a snowstorm, essentially declaring martial law during a snowstorm.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I remember screaming about that because it seemed more and more like they were declaring martial law for just about everything. But the point is that states of emergency can be declared. They can tell you to shelter in place, and what happens to your self-driving car when a state of emergency shelter-in-place order is in place? And then what if you have an emergency and you need to get to the hospital or someplace for stabilizing care? I mean, these are real issues, but I can completely see this being a reality someday.
Sure, and the technology people don't think about things like, they don't care about things like that.
Until it happens.
they don't care about it even then. But they care about the development of technology. What can we do? There is never a thought of, yeah, we can do it, but should we do it?
You're talking about the developers. I'm talking about the end users. When it actually happens to you, then...
Oh, Definitely. But the way that Silicon Valley is working, the way this whole technology business is working, our government is funding all the research and development on all of this stuff, on the mm-hmm. ultimate police state. And it they socialize the cost and privatize the profit. And that's the way it's working. It's the government paid...
That's a very good way of putting it.
Yeah.
They socialize the cost and privatize the profit.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they're making it seem like that all of this technology for the highways is just, it's a function of consumer demand for more and greater and better technology. And that is not true. That is absolutely not true. It is the government and probably that unholy alliance that, I talked about, which includes DARPA, that is driving this. It's technology demand push. They are pushing the demand on the consumer. It's a false economic system where they are really forcing this technology on the consumer because that's all there is to buy.
Yeah. Let me go to Florida and take a call here real quick. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
This is Harvey in Florida.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. See if my connection is all right. I was having problems. But
yeah, I noticed you popped up and then disappeared.
Yeah, I got a new phone, so my smartphone's not all that smart.
Yeah.
I finally broke down and got a smartphone. It knows every single thing, every place you've ever been. It's unbelievable.
So what's
you can check anything you've ever done with it.
Oh, boy. So what's on your mind there?
Okay, well, I was listening about your self-driving cars, the decapitation aspect of that. That must be an ISIS car. Maybe they're going into the car production system.
Hey, you know what? For years and years, Saudi Arabia hired a lot of American
decapitating cars.
Wait a minute.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
What'd you say, Vicky?
I want to tell you.
Hang on, Harvey. Go ahead, Vicky. Repeat what you just said.
I said for years and years, Saudi Arabia employed a lot of American programmers over there. And I always thought it was for like oil field. But, you know, as I've studied, you know, over the years, all of this stuff, I really wonder if it was. Because you really don't need that many programmers to run your oil operations.
Did you? Are you able to hear her? Hear Vicky Harvey?
Yes, I could hear her fine. Okay. By the way, she's absolutely brilliant. She's so smart and so wonderful. I'm so glad to hear you guys on Saturday. What a wonderful team you are.
Thanks.
But I had sent you a story that I saw last week in the New York Times. I sent it to you about a half hour ago. Take a look on your email, Darren.
Okay.
It's where the U.S. admits they wasted $1 billion trying to destroy Iraq, and they're giving up the ghost, whether or not it's a planted story or not. And they tell you they finally admitted in this New York Times story that they were trained in Turkey and in Jordan, and it gives you the whole lowdown on it. Now that it's coming to an end, I guess they're spilling the beans, but it's probably not really coming to an end. So check out that story that I sent you.
Okay.
And earlier today, you were talking about the space weapons being able to knock out the nuclear missiles that may come from North Korea. But one of the problems about knocking down nuclear missiles at mid-flight is the radiation goes everywhere. I guess
that's what
Ronald
I was
Reagan
talking about.
Wasn't thinking about that.
Yeah.
Right. Ronald Reagan wasn't thinking ahead. You start blasting these nuclear missiles out of the sky, where do you think that radiation goes?
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the problem.
Yeah.
That's always a problem when you don't think ahead. So
North Korea, they're just testing the missile technology, and I don't think they're armed missiles. So
not
they really
yet.
Ought to just, you know, when he pops one up, they ought to shoot it down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Why aren't we doing that? That's the question. And I think the answer lies in the fact that they want the crisis because they want the war.
Well, they have to, in order to build the technological system in all of these countries, see, for the... These systems, the global transportation system, is global. So they've got to get it in all of the countries. And they really, in order to build this technology in countries that are really not very progressive, it's more convenient to do demolition with bombs than it is piece by piece. So they destroy the country with bombs, and then they rebuild it with technology.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, earlier, Darren, you were playing the tape of Bill Clinton saying about his wonderful nuclear agreement with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And in that statement, I think it got by you a little bit. The fact that he was telling them how Japan's going to help them reset their nuclear power plants so they'll work better and they won't have nuclear material to build bombs. Like what they built in Fukushima. They were going to send them the Fukushima special. Isn't that unbelievable?
Yeah.
the nuclear experts that built the Fukushima, that was General Electric and the Japanese working together to make a beautiful nuclear plant.
Called field testing. Install it and test it.
Yeah, that was part of the field testing. Guinea pigs. Guinea pigs are us.
Yeah.
And maybe with these self-driving cars, the U.S. government will give them blanket immunity like they do with the vaccine companies.
Well,
so everybody that gets decapitated will get a check from the U.S. government.
You know,
for $250.
It could very well happen.
Yeah, but that's about what you get.
To move the technology further.
If you could prove they did it.
as you'll hear here in this hearing, as I progress with this, they talk about absorbing the cost, and I could totally see the cost being so prohibitive or so detrimental that they need a bailout. They've already bailed out the card companies once.
Yep.
That's really you couldn't make. I don't know how you find this material. You're terrific.
Well, we just do the best we can, Harvey.
We just notice things.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot. I'm gonna
keep up the good work and check out that story I sent you. It'll blow your mind.
All right. Blessings to you. I got it right here. All right. Let's see. Hit that button there. All right. Let's move on here. You know, Wendell Wallach, it's kind of interesting because they brought in an ethicist. She's from Yale's Interdisciplinary Center for Bioethics and got into a subject that we've discussed before on the show, regarding the subject of, you know, kind of, you remember the old secular humanists lifeboat scenario where people would determine, you know, where if you are on a lifeboat and it's sinking, you got to throw somebody overboard, who is it going to be? And you got a kid with a cold. Well, the kid might give everybody the cold, so let's get rid of the kid. Somebody else, you know, well, they're handicapped or whatever, so they can't be of value to society, so let's throw them overboard. You know, it's this idea that certain lives are valued more than others. And if you're not a part of the community, the whole communitarian philosophy, really, that's what it really boils down to. It is a communitarian philosophy.
Yeah, who
and that's what they were teaching.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, some people have more value than others. And let's just throw the ones out to sea, overboard, let them drown, because they're not of value. They can't contribute like others to the quote-unquote community. Well, it's the same type of deal that they're having they're considering now with these cars. And this Wendell Wallach is talking about this. Not in reference to the lifeboat scenario, but it's pretty much the same thing.
The big ethical challenge that people have been talking about for a long time, which is sort of a false challenge, is this trolley car problem. Trolley car problems have been around since 1967. They're really ethical thought experiments about what people would do if you have to make a choice between saving five lives at the expense of another life, but it requires an action on your part. And these have recently been translated to driverless cars, and there's been a lot of publicity around it, and there's been some research on it, and it's found that consumers in general say the car should kill the least amount of people, even if it means it kills the driver or the occupant, or at least the humans who are occupying that car. Except nobody's going to buy that car. All the research shows that. So in order to stop a once-in-a-trillion-mile event from happening, we want the car to take an action that will stop millions of people from buying driverless cars. And if they don't buy driverless cars, we're likely to see thousands of deaths that would have happened that perhaps could have been stopped with the use of driverless cars.
Okay, again, that is all assumption. that these things have not been widely tested. Until they're widely tested, you can't make a blanket statement. Oh, they're, you know, here's the thing, folks. We people, we get along pretty well on the roadways, even today. Even with all the phones, all the distractions, we've always had distractions. We've always had crying kids in the back seat that we've had to, you know, fighting with each other. We've always had people do unexpected things. I would say the vast majority of accidents happen because people, because unexpected things happen in the roadway, whether it be another driver pulling out in front of you, or whether it be obstructions in the roadways. A lot of things happen because of unexpected occurrences. But that being said, and you're not going to completely do away with unexpected occurrences. This notion that these things are safer, you can't make that statement until they're tested. But this is the presumption. Well, people can't drive very well anymore. I disagree. I think people drive pretty good. Now, are there a lot of accidents? Are there a lot more accidents due to technology and the increase in, you know, these mobile devices and things that people can't take their eyes off? Sure, absolutely. But this idea that people can't drive all of a sudden, this idea that we don't get along with each other very well on the roadways, I think has to be knocked down. And the technology that's being brought in as this end-all, be-all solution to distracted driving is highly experimental. Mm-hmm. It has not been thoroughly tested. It has not been it's not been hardened. It's not had a real-world experience and on a wide-scale basis. And until it does, you can't sit there and say that it's more safe than people operating motor vehicles, because I'm not buying it.
And you can't, and what all of the components in a car, they're all produced by different manufacturers. So you're talking about not just, you know, a single component, you're talking about the integration of components in a car. And I've worked on programs that had been working beautifully for, you know, 10 years, 15 years, and just all of a sudden, you know, a certain set of conditions come up, the right set of conditions that had never come up before, and the program fails. So even if they do a lot of testing and it's reliable, you know, 95% of the time or 99% of the time, there's still that 1%. I don't know. I'm not going to get into a vehicle going 70 miles an hour that I'm not in control of.
Yeah.
Well, except on, you know, a train, but there's always a train driver, you know, that,
even that, funny that you mentioned that, because now they're developing systems to literally take the, in fact, there's something called automatic train control that we've talked about on the broadcast. Yeah, there's somebody
there.
They've
had that for a long time. But you know what? In I think New York or New Jersey or somewhere, they outlawed those. There has to be a trained driver.
Yeah.
Even if the driver does nothing but sit in the chair, he has to be there.
Well, the automatic train control is supposedly, and I don't know, I'm not an expert on it, but I do know that from what I've read, it can override the driver of the train. Now, whether it's just to override it in order to bring the train, to slow the train down, I guess I wouldn't have a problem with that. You know, like if it gets to a corner and the technology sees that the driver of the train is going too fast to handle the corner and it's at risk of derailing, so it automatically slows the train down.
Well, I think it works the opposite. If there's automation in the train, the automation is driving the train, and the operator is sitting there to take control if things go wrong. So I think it's the opposite of what you just said there.
Well, from what I've read, it's exactly the way I said it.
Really?
Yeah, because the problem that they, the part of the reason why they're really pushing this is because, once again, the same argument, distracted driving. It's a monotonous job watching those two rails in front of you, and you can either doze off or you can get bored and not be sharp, or you've got, even though in some cases it's illegal, maybe all cases it's illegal, people still do it. They get on their phones, they're not paying attention, and we can't have that. And so the technology is there to try to... It would be interesting to have some train operators. I wish we could have them talk about the technology so that they're more versed in it than we are. But this is what I've read. The idea is to override the operator and slow down the train. Now, if it can be slowed down, though, can it be sped up? Can the technology, if it can take control, can it cause it to be out of control? These are questions I think would be very interesting. I guess we'll have to do more research on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see what... Anyway, bottom of the hour, let's go ahead and take the break, and we'll continue on the other side. This is Governor America. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the broadcast. This is Governor America with Vicki Davis and Darren Weeks. And we continue on here. 844-646-8376 if you got anything you'd like to say. 844-646-8376 is our toll-free number. That's 844-6-GOVERN. And we're talking, got kind of in a little bit of a side discussion regarding automatic train control and whether or not it can override the driver. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that was really the purpose of it, is to, if the driver is doing something unsafe, this system would override the driver to slow the train down. And I don't know if it has the ability to, if someone got into it somehow, to create a problem, you know, that's certainly an interesting scenario to consider. Anyway, we got a call on the line, I believe, from California. Hello, caller. Who do we have here? Whoops.
Daniel from FEMA Region 9.
Hey, Daniel. How you doing?
Hi. I have to agree with Harvey. I really look forward to your show on Saturdays.
Thank you.
Even though it can be depressing at times, but it gets me energized as far as, you know, what my solution that I like to work on and proselytize. So to me, the common thread among the problems that you list is government is the problem.
Yeah.
But I'm calling about the railroad concept because I have quite a bit of experience on, I trained with the BNSF Railroad, the old Burlington Northern Santa Fe,
okay,
which I believe is the second largest railroad, and then I went to work at CSX, which is an Eastern Railroad, pretty much all up and down the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah,
I worked as train crew, and I also worked as a what they call a control operator, which is the manual version of what you're talking about with automatic train control. I can mainly speak for the large freight-carrying railroads.
Okay.
And a little bit the passenger. A friend of mine is a passenger engineer for Amtrak. And I can speak a little bit of light rail because I lived in San Diego where they have a light rail system. And I worked with people that that worked on that. So I know a little bit about the automatic train control, too. That's a newer concept. But on the freight railroads, what that means is they have sensors in the rail, and the sensors work with a computer, a central computer, to give signals to the trains.
Okay.
In the locomotive and on the tracks. It doesn't actually control the locomotive at all.
Okay. But when you say it doesn't control the locomotive, it doesn't control the throttle, or it doesn't...
Right. It doesn't control any part of it. It doesn't, excuse me, it doesn't affect the brakes or the... that's all done by the engineer. excuse me. But that's, there may be a different type of, I know on the New York subway, I did work with a lady who had been a motorman, I think they still call it, on the New York subway, that they do have an automatic brake system that if they go through a red signal on the New York subway, it trips the brakes. There's actual physical thing that sticks up next to the rails that trips the brakes and sets in an automatic emergency brakes on the subway. I know they have that. And I know there are small light rail, like at I believe it's a SeaTac airport, where there's not even an operator in the cab, if there is even something you would call a cab of those. Now those don't operate at a very high speed, but they're automated. They give you a recording saying when the doors are going to close, and they would stop if there was an obstruction on the rails or something like that. That's totally automated, but it's very low speed. So I don't know if that system is anything like what you're talking about.
Well, since you're from California, you must be familiar with the BART, right? Bay Area Rapid Transit?
I've been on it. Yes, I have been on it.
Okay. The BART was designed to be a fully automated train, and I was living in California at the time when they opened up BART, and they had all kinds of problems. You know, one that I remember was a train overshot the station, and if the train was not in the station, the doors wouldn't open, so they couldn't even evacuate the people through a back door.
I remember that. I was Yeah, I do remember that. I don't believe they stayed automated. Last I was on there, they did have a motorman on each train.
Well, I think they always had the motorman on there, but it was designed to be automated so that they didn't need to have a motorman on there. But of course, you know.
Yeah. Part of the problem with a freight railroad is you've got so many trains. There's so many reasons for delays. They have a large dispatch center at CSX, and I know BNSF and Union Pacific has them too, and Norfolk Southern. Theirs is, I believe, in Philadelphia. And that, being a dispatcher, is one of the hardest jobs in railroading. That is very tough. They have to juggle. They're responsible for an area. The last job I had with the railroad was sort of a miniature version of that. I was responsible for an area around one city called Connellsville, Pennsylvania. And you're responsible for that area, you're in radio contact with a lot of the trains, and you have signals on a board that show you where the tracks are occupied. My job didn't have that. I had to do it just by radio. But what you're responsible for is giving signals, the trackside signals that you've probably seen, the red, yellow, and green signals, to the engineers for the different trains going through there. And also, you operate the track switches, many of the track switches that actually direct the train onto one track, off one track and onto the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a human being's job, and it's a very hard job.
Wow.
Imagine, that's kind of like air traffic controllers for trains.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much what my job was, the airport area traffic controller, but with trains for that area around Connellsville. That's how I would explain people what my job was, because people had to, there are many, many rules operating railroads. The railroads grew up basically around the Civil War time in the United States, and a lot of generals had power positions, you know, CEO-type positions on these railroads. And because really during the war, railroads were very important, too, for moving troops and cannons and ammunition and all that kind of stuff. And so there's a kind of a military aspect to the way the railroads are run. There are rule books, and you have to know these rules as a train crew or whatever your job is. There's a book of safety rules, there's a book of locomotive operating rules, there's a book of general operating rules. There's safety rules, all kinds of rules that govern everything that you do. And they also govern the signals. And so that certain signals, not just really, they have three colors, but there are also blinking signals. There's, for instance, red over yellow, or yellow over red, actually, and blinking yellow. And all of those mean different things to the engineer, and they have to know all of that.
Wow.
Now, there's another aspect. You talked about fatigue.
Yeah.
That is a very big problem on the railroads, because usually the more junior people don't have enough seniority to have the daytime jobs around the railroad yard or something. So the long-distance jobs are often the more junior people. And so they're a little bit unfamiliar. They don't. The body hasn't quite acclimated. I don't know if it ever does, because you don't have a shift. You have a rotating.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much you got to be a certain type of person to be able to do this sort of work.
Yeah.
Some people are cut out for it.
And there's
some
a lot of good things about it. It's fun. A lot of it is fun. A lot of it is dangerous, and some of it is actually scary, and a lot of it is very monotonous. And if you can get used to that or work with it, it pays pretty well to be on the train crew.
Hmm.
Now, they do have a device that I found a little amusing at first, but it's actually very important, a thing called an alerter. And what that is, if you don't move a control or hit a particular button within about, I think it's a minute or 2 minutes, I forget what the actual time is, a light starts flashing right in front of you.
Is that the dead man switch?
And it goes, is that, well, no, they don't have a dead man pedal. They used to have a dead man pedal that you had your foot on all the time. This is something that serves a similar purpose, but you just have to press this button once every couple minutes, or move a control, which you're moving controls like the throttle pretty regularly on a train. You have to sort of get a feel for how the what the next hill is going to do, and there are all kinds of curves and all kinds of things that affect the train, and you have to keep it moving and moving within the proper speed and legal speed for the train. But anyway, this thing starts flashing first very dimly, and then more and more brightly, and then a tone starts coming out, a pretty loud blaring tone that starts going, and if you don't stop that tone by the time it gets to the maximum, the engine shuts off and the train goes into emergency braking.
So it does have some automation that can't override the operator. Maybe that's what I was reading about. I was just, as you were talking there, I saw the entry on Wikipedia for automatic train stop, or ATS. They say it's a system on a train that automatically stops a train if certain situations occur, such as unresponsive train operator, earthquake, disconnected rail, train running over a stop signal, etc., to prevent accidents. In some scenarios, it functions as type of a dead man switch. Automatic train stop differs, however, they say, from the concept of automatic train control, in that ATS does not feature an onboard speed control mechanism. So I'm glad you cleared that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know of any trains, and I've been away from it for 8 years now. I've been retired, but I don't know of any rail freight type railroad, national size railroad, that uses train control in the sense you're talking about. ATC, though, is a term that they use. And what they mean is the signals are in a certain area are controlled by the location of the train.
Mm-hmm.
And they will give a red signal, let's say, to an engineer that is going to keep him out of an area. But if he breaks the red signal, there's nothing physically to stop him, unless there's a bad switch that would derail the train ahead. Sometimes these red signals will warn you that there's a switch ahead, a track switch.
Right, right.
That is set wrong for your movement. And if you go through that red signal and get to that switch, you could derail the train. And so that will be a warning, but it's up to the engineer to heed it.
Yeah.
The only thing that physically stops the train is the braking system that is set up for the alerter, or if there is a break in the air pipe that goes through the whole train, that there's air brakes that run the whole train.
Right.
And if the the hose breaks or something like that, it will put that part of the train into emergency braking. They have emergency air reservoirs on the cars, and they will release if the pressure is lost. Mm. And it will, that will, and if that something on the engine, if that senses that that happened, that the train braking system has gone into emergency, it turns the engine off.
Okay, well, that's good to know. I appreciate you calling in and letting us know that. I'm going to move on here and continue with the
okay, sure,
autonomous vehicle stuff, but I appreciate that, Daniel.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Okay,
thank you.
Blessings to you guys.
Blessings to you, too.
Okay, thanks, Vicki.
Yep, talk to you later.
You too.
All right, so that's Daniel in California. I'm glad he called in to clarify that. And trains are something that's always fascinated me anyway. And I was a little bit familiar with the dead man's kill switch because there's a periscope operator out of Finland, I believe it was, back a while ago, and he was doing scopes from his train, and he questioned, you know, he kind of said, maybe I'm not supposed to do this, but he was doing it anyway. But I found it fascinating because he was kind of showing the inside of the cockpit, if that's the right word, the engine of the train, and how everything operates, and it was pretty fascinating to watch him.
Well, I'm pretty happy to find out that the freight trains are actually run by people.
Yeah.
And yeah, not technology.
But then we have the cars. We have the cars that aren't. So anyway, earlier we were talking about Wendell Wallach, the ethicist at Yale's Interdisciplinary System for Bioethics, and his idea that your car could kill you if it decides somebody else is more important, or you have other people who are in an opposing car, and somebody's got to die, so who's going to die?
Stop. A once-in-a-trillion-mile event from happening. We want the car to take an action that will stop millions of people from buying driverless cars. And if they don't buy driverless cars, we're likely to see thousands of deaths that would have happened that perhaps could have been stopped with the use of driverless cars. It's just showing it's kind of a false challenge. But the interesting thing about this particular challenge is it's brought to our attention that driving is not simply a lawful activity where a car stops at a stop sign, and if it sees a ball, it gets prepared to brake in case a child is anywhere in the vicinity. No, it's a social practice, and there are these countless different situations that can arise that there is no simple right or wrong, or perhaps even technological solution for what the car should do. So consider four cars coming to the four-way stop at the same time. Who goes? What happens if the human drivers are gaming the driverless cars? Consider New York City and the taxis trying to gain driverless cars. The driverless car might be stuck at an intersection for a long period of time. So we have this array of both practical and ethical and finally legal and accountability issues that are coming into play in this space. And we don't have the technology yet. The technology isn't ready for prime time to solve them, nor have we as a society decided how we want some of these challenges to be handled. In other words, they don't get decided by existing ethics. We have to come up with new norms. We have to agree upon what we would like.
Okay, but the problem is they're not asking society, are they?
No, only in these arcane programs that only people like you and I watch.
Who decides? Who ultimately gets to decide what the car is going to do in a given situation? It's going to be whoever is responsible for the people that write the code.
That's right.
And they're not asking anybody.
That's true of all computer programs. It doesn't matter, you know, whether the specs are available and the instruction manuals and everything else for how the code works. The only person that really knows how the code works is the guy or the woman who wrote it.
Or the team, the group.
Well, no. Groups don't write code. People, individuals,
right,
write code.
Right.
And their code is integrated into the code that other people write. It's writing code is a singular activity.
And every bit of it is proprietary. Every bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless the government forces it to be cracked open and examined. And again, we're coming back to the same type of scenario that we have with the voter machines that we were talking about earlier. The lack of the ability, the potential lack of ability of auditing and finding flaws and problems. Because with every system, Vicky, and I don't have to tell you this, every new system, there's inevitably going to be vulnerabilities. There's inevitably going to be errors. And if people don't have the ability to go in there and poke at it and find out what's wrong with it, it's, you know, in this case, people are going to die. It's even more serious than the election system. Because then you're just, this candidate gets in office when it should have been the other candidate. Well, in this case, it's people may go off a cliff. People could go careening into, you know, sidewalks full of people, which, by the way, I find rather interesting that at the time that we have all these self-driving cars and autonomous push for all these autonomous vehicles, all of a sudden now we're seeing terrorist attacks with automobiles running over and trucks running over people. Everywhere.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I never thought about that, Darren, but you're right.
Now, here's a push for, let's get rid of all the controls, not let you have any control over your vehicle at all because, well, you might be a terrorist. Anyway, again, here's Carlos Gossin of the Renault-Nissan Alliance elaborating on the technical and ethical problems.
Well, I totally agree. That's one of the reasons I'm telling you, autonomous cars are immediate. Driverless cars are going to take some time. Not only because technology, we still have some problems to solve, but I'm very optimistic about the solution to the technical problem. But there are many, many questions which have been outlined here, which are totally true, about you're putting a machine without anybody in this machine on the roads. And we know that there are some cases where it cannot make a decision. It cannot make a decision. Or if you wanted to make a decision, you're going to have to make some choices and some priorities. And the car maker alone cannot make these priorities. He's going to have to go to the regulators to tell him what are the priorities into these cases. Mm-hmm. So what we're doing now in order to solve, again, we are in prototyping here. We are just testing. Is when the car is in front of a situation that it cannot solve, whatever powerful is the computer you're putting into the car, because the car is in front of a situation where it's a no, no, no. Okay? So it stops. Then it has to go to a human being sitting in a control tower and give him the photo of the situation, and the human being tell him, okay, cross this line. Okay? Because I know there is no car coming, cross this line. You have plenty of no's. This is a no you're going to break. It's human being. By the way, it's not very far from what NASA's doing. You can ask yourself today, when NASA sends something on Mars, plenty of computer, still human being is on Earth and making, in some cases, some decision. We are collaborating with NASA to try to say, when the machine or the robot is in front of situation where you have plenty of no's, what do you do? What they do is come back to Earth, and we tell you exactly what we do. Now, it's with the
So you're going to have your car consulting some dude or dudette in a tower someplace about what it should do when it encounters a situation. Doesn't that sound great? You know, I come back to the problem I had back when I was on a trip in a van. I have a full-size passenger van. My entire family was in there. My wife's parents were in there as well. We were on a trip to the Smoky Mountains. I was driving down the highway. I had a concrete barrier on my left and an 18-wheel semi-tractor trailer on my right. In the middle of the road, I came upon a four-wheeler that had been being evidently on somebody's... In other words, somebody lost their load. And this four-wheeler was in the middle of my lane. Again, concrete barrier on my left, semi-tractor trailer, 18-wheeler on my right. What do you do? What would my self-driving car have done? Oh, I guess it'll send the message to the dude in the control tower. But by then, I'm gone.
Yeah.
And I got out of that situation unscathed. To this day, I don't know how. I slammed on the brakes. I think I moved toward the semi-tractor trailer because obviously the concrete barrier wasn't going anywhere. And by some miracle, the combination of the two moves, I ended up not wrecking. Now, the people in the vehicle were freaking out. Our vehicle, I mean. My father-in-law was about ready to jump because he didn't see the obstruction in the middle of the road. He just thought something happened to me, I guess. But,
well, you remember that suicidal deer?
Oh, yeah.
That's just one of the many situations. Now, who's more important, you and your family or that deer?
Well,
you better hope that the guy that wrote the program is not one of these
animal rights activists. Exactly. Exactly.
In the world of computer, this situation is less and less frequent because you're solving more and more problems. But we don't foresee a situation yet where the car can solve all the problems in a way where there is absolutely no ethical problem or value. Like, that's why I'm saying autonomous cars are here because you have the driver in the car, and at the end of the day, he makes a decision. And when
okay, I'm gonna take pause it there because we got the top of the hour break, and we'll continue this into the next hour. Stay with us, folks. Vicki Davis is here. I'm Darren Weeks, and we'll be back here on Govern America.
The crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
Just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, and streaming live from FEMA Region 5. This is the third and final hour of Govern America. It continues to be the 5th of August, 2017, as we move rapidly through this final hour here. And your phone calls are welcome, 844-646-8376. If you have anything to say, 844-6-GOVERN, 844-6-GOVERN. And anyway, we were talking a little bit from sharing some audio from an ethicist here. His name was Carlos Gazan. Actually, he's from the Renault-Nissan Alliance, talking about the ethical situations here regarding self-driving cars.
The car has a problem, it gives back the control to the driver. But when there is no driver in the car, situation is a little bit more complicated. Technically, we can solve it, but there is still a lot of things wrong.
There's still a lot of things wrong. Yes, a lot of things could be wrong, too, as time progresses with this whole scenario. So I got one more clip from the World Economic Forum, and I also do have a congressional hearing that dealt with this subject more recently. this final clip, and there is a lot more in this World Economic Forum session. This kind of just, I'm just trying touching upon some of the highlights of this whole thing, but the entire video, I encourage people to watch. It'll be in the show notes. But this is the final clip here.
I wanted to go back to the issue about the autonomous driving, because even with the driver in the car, that driver is going to get lulled into a false sense of security. And so when something critical happens, do you really want this driver that's been very distracted, not really aware of the situation around them? So I think for autonomous vehicles, even the early versions to work extremely well, there's going to need to be a lot of situational awareness. The car is actually going to need to be monitoring what's going on around it and start to predict when some kind of a situation may come up, so that it can cause you as a driver to be a little bit more aware and focused on what's going on around, instead of reading my paper or watching a movie or doing whatever else I'm doing. I think that aspect of the human-machine interface is going to be an interesting area for all of us to work on for a little while, and machine intelligence will help a lot. And doing these kinds of things where the car is actually monitoring the state of the driver, I think this is going to be an important technology, and people don't talk about that all that much.
But there are real problematics in the trade-off between a driver and the system itself. Even if the system anticipates that it's coming upon a situation that it doesn't know what to do, that doesn't mean a human who is napping or picked up a book or is texting is going to be able to respond in time. Right. It's, at least in the U.S., it's starting to look like the courts are going to rule against the car companies in those situations, and therefore I think the car companies are now understanding they are going to have to take on some of the accountability and liability, or at least through insurance or the pricing of the car and handling the insurance elements of that. But I also want to come back on what is really in the hands of the regulatory authorities and even in the hands of the car manufacturers, and to what extent we, the citizenry, needs to be engaged in this particular challenge. Because at this point, we are talking about life and death. In some cases, these are experimental technologies that we're putting on the road. That makes us human subjects in research that we have never consented to be in. And that's one thing if somebody has downloaded software from Tesla and has decided to use that autonomy feature. But it's very different when you consider that someday there's going to be a high-profile incident in which a civilian, perhaps a child even, is killed by an autonomous car.
But we've had that.
Well, we had that, but it wasn't high enough profile. It was the Florida incident. And I'm just saying there will be a high-profile incident. I don't know what will set that off. I don't know that it'll be the first or the tenth. But we are moving into a realm where technology is moving into the driver's seat as a primary determinant of humanity's future. And we need to be engaged in what standards, what morals, what norms we want to have set in place, and we need to communicate that to our regulators.
What do you think of that, Vicki?
I think that's a very important issue. And there was a case, I don't know what year it was, around 2005 or 2006, where a busload of high school football players, they said it was driver error, but I always wondered about it, because what happened was that the bus took an exit that it wasn't supposed to take, and it was going at high speed, and it didn't slow down at the top of the exit, went up to an overpass, mm-hmm. and the bus just kept going. And so it basically got up to the top and flew over the top and then, you know, crashed down on the other side. And I've always suspected that was technology in the bus that caused that problem. But of course, that was very early on, before they were making this kind of technology known to the public.
Right.
There's
going to be more of this.
You can tell, you know, how many variables there are. How many conditions does a programmer have to anticipate?
It's literally endless possibilities of things that could happen on the roadway.
Absolutely.
How do you possibly program every single possible thing that could happen? I just mm-hmm. don't see any way it can be done. That's why I don't think these things are going to be ready anytime soon. And really, if ever, but they're sure being pushed, and it's being pushed hard. Tell you what, we're going to call
with all these technology systems. With this whole obsession with technology, they're putting people's lives at risk.
Yes,
in the healthcare field, the remote technology, you know, radiologists reading X-rays remotely. They're depending on the technology, the personalized medicine that they're anticipating. That is pure human experimentation, also medical experimentation. The smart meters on your house. It's not just the meter itself, but the control of devices in your home, and what about all of the radiation in the air, the radio waves, microwave, and so forth?
In every single case, we are lab rats. We are guinea pigs.
Yes, because all they're thinking about is the development of the technology and not the impact on society, the impact on people.
And their shareholders.
It's like people are just guinea pigs for technology development.
Yeah, it's sad. I tell you what, let's go to Missouri. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Hi there. I tell you what, this is Ron. I want one of those autonomous cars, and I'm going to come up, and I will take your wife to her next doctor's appointment. Now, how safe do you feel?
Well, I mean, that's a good example. I mean, Michelle, we just found out that she can't drive for 6 months now because of this problem that she's having. And even though she feels them coming, you know, she's having fainting spells, which she had 24 years ago. And for some reason, I think it's stress-related, but for whatever the case, they're coming back now. And out of an abundance of caution, the doctors are saying she shouldn't drive. And the rule in Michigan is 6 months. Of course, that's for epilepsy, and this is not epilepsy. But they're saying that, you know, I mean, it could be a liability issue. And so now we're having to run her everywhere. So, I mean, this technology could benefit me at the moment. But I would rather take her everywhere she needs to go rather than have to put her in a car where you're trusting some algorithm that is flawed. And you... Look, I have no doubt that in many cases, self-driving or autonomous vehicles, and the definitions are different, but I have no doubt that in some cases, many cases, mostly ideal cases, they can be operated very safe. But what about the small percentage of time where you're wrong, where something goes wrong?
Well, in a logical society, that would be just kind of a casualty of a logical society.
Collateral damage.
And I agree, yeah. Well, I do have some updates for you. If you remember 2 weeks ago, we talked about the poor prisoners in the St. Louis workhouse, just how hot they were, and they just couldn't breathe, and it was a tragedy. And Vicky really felt sorry for them.
Uh-huh.
So the Monday after the show, somebody donated $75,000, thank you, Vicky, so that they could have air conditioning in the jail, and now there's a new problem.
Yeah?
Now they're too cold.
Oh, no! Well, they can put a sweater on.
Did you donate?
Wait,
did
they're in jail.
Did you donate that $75,000 there, Vicky?
Well, you know
that was
I
very,
would.
Very kind.
That was. So now a contractor has come forward and discovered that Vicky was right on this, that somehow the state of Missouri has underpaid the jail system by around $7 million a year for the last 20-some-odd years. So now they think they deserve all this money back, and the contractor says he could build a new jail for that.
Oh, well, I'll be well. Darned.
Well, well, well.
That's all coincidental, Vicky.
Go figure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Isn't that
And
amazing?
Let's see, just so we need more things. I've sent all kinds of strange stories up to Darren, but I heard one from the Secretary of State was on Lars Larson. And he apparently, it's a good-sized office, he wanted to have a wall put in with a door between the two offices. $72,000 if he goes through GSA.
Just for a door?
For a door and a wall.
Does that include preparation of all the paperwork and everything and the studies that have to be done? I'm sure there's some kind of impact studies that have to be done.
You got to study the environment before you put up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Then there's an 11-year-old kid that volunteered to cut the White House lawn. Have you caught this story? I sent it up to you, Darren.
Oh,
well, the Parks Department says he can't do that because of federal regulations. So Donald Trump sent back, said he can cut the Rose Garden. That's our private area.
Well, listen, he's got to pass a security clearance before he can possibly get in there anywhere near the White House.
I mean, 11-year-old. I mean, you got to watch these 11-year-olds.
That's right. Hey, they can be pretty shady.
I wonder if the lawnmower is going to meet the EPA standards.
Well, you can't have an 11-year-old terrorist with high-speed blades going around the White House.
Well, you know, an 11-year-old can be a terrorist, you know.
Well, I've seen many of them.
They don't have weapons particularly, but they are in and of themselves a terrorist thing.
We've been in some restaurants where some of these screaming kids, we can't call them terrorists, but they're terrorists to my nerves, and they're terrorists to my peace and sanity, and being able to eat a nice, quiet lunch without being disrupted by chaos.
Yeah, well, that's called parenting.
We were on an airplane.
Unfortunately, it's on the decline.
We were on an airplane with one of those terrorists that was, I don't know, about 16 months old or so, that cried all the way from Jamaica to Miami.
Wow. That is a red-eye flight.
Some airlines that are actually considering having kid-free trips, and, of course, you know, their parents' groups are going nuts, but what do you do?
Yeah, well...
Yeah, nothing you can do with them.
Once upon a time, the parent would be able to have the freedom to bend the child over and deal with the problem, shall we say, without risking losing their children to social services. But that era apparently has slipped away.
Well, you can't really do that with the little kids on airplanes because their ears don't pop.
Well, the babies are one thing.
Yeah, so they, and you can't give them gum to chew, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah.
I know that some of the restaurants, I know we have a couple here, and I've heard a couple over in Pittsburgh that are kids-free restaurants, and they said they're tired of the non-disciplined kids disrupting everybody's meal, and we were in one in Sykeston, Missouri, and it says no children are allowed at the food bar. This little kid came up there, the manager is very polite, said, "Where's your parents?" He pointed over there, so he walked him back over. And said, "We do not allow children at the bar." And this mother got indignant and just went wild. And he says, "Ma'am, you paid for your food. We will bring it out to you in the gold box. And please do not come back here again." I said, "Good for him."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because little kids, they put their hands in the food.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, some adults are just about as bad, but.
Well, that's true.
So, well, listen, Ron, I appreciate the call.
Like food bars and stuff. You know, none of that kind of stuff. But anyway, I just thought I'd give you a jailhouse update that, of course, Vicki, you were right. There's a contractor now willing to help out.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, I'm so happy. Yeah. I'm so happy they're going to be, they're cool, but too cool. So.
Yeah, that's kind of the way it always seems to happen, doesn't it?
Well, see, now it's 58 degrees down here, you see, but I guess, I don't know how they did the system, but I guess they can't turn the air conditioner off as the temperature fluctuates here in Missouri up and down, so now they're too cold.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? Wow.
And they can't have sweaters, Vicki, because they can make a weapon out of that.
Yeah, I neglected to think about that part of it.
Yeah.
Well, oh, yeah, absolutely, Vicki. I mean, I guess we need to get to maybe heavier prison suits. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens with that. Hey, thanks, Ron. I appreciate the call. Whoops. I'm going to go ahead and go to the next call here real quick here, and it's in Texas, I believe. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, Darren, it's Alan. How are you and Vicki doing today?
Well, we're hanging in there, man, trying to keep our sanity. Which is not that easy.
You still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, it blanked for a minute there.
That's weird. What's on your mind?
But getting back to the this driverless cars, I mean, we all know the ultimate objective is they don't like us, you know, being able to go out and travel freely, you know, wherever we want to. You know, they tried, you know, Trans-Texas Corridor, you know, the highway system that was going to be, you know, shut off with only, you know, limited access points, mm-hmm. entry points. And I can see this happening with the driverless cars, you know, that there will come to a point of where your trip, wherever you want to go, will have to be approved. You'll have to go, like, through a central, you know, data processing center or something like that to see if the roadways are clear enough, if there's priority traffic ahead of you, that, you know, you will not be able to go wherever you want to, whenever you want to, you know. So you will go in and plug your destination into your car, and it will, you know, you know, connect with a central area, and they will say whether you can take your trip or not. You know, so I can see this, you know, being very limiting on our mobility, as you know, and freedom as people to travel where we want to.
Yeah, I think that's where we're headed, don't you?
And that is the idea. That, as far as I'm concerned, that is the objective. It's all for control of people.
Well, and all the pricing of these cars, in fact, I think somebody in one of those, in the World Economic Forum session, made, you know, they alluded to the technology is driving up the cost of the car. So as these things continue to, this technology continues to move forward, and all of this proprietary software and, you know, hardware that has to be integrated into the vehicle, it causes things to be more expensive, and consequently, people are not going to be able to afford it. So you're going to be priced out of the marketplace as far as buying cars are concerned. As as the older cars, I try to fix up the cars I have for the most part, and I think there's some merit to that. But the problem is that as a car ages, and I can tell you from experience, more and more stuff wears out on it, and increasingly, I'm having difficulty finding parts for a lot of these cars, especially given the fact that you have, you know, the Obama's Cash for Clunkers program, which wiped out a lot of old cars from the junkyards so that you weren't able to use them for parts anymore.
Oh, yeah. Exactly, you know. Back when it was just, you know, you open your hood, and, you know, and the motor sits there, and there's a carburetor with, you know, three or four vacuum lines, one to run, you know, the distributor, one to run your windshield wipers. You know, I thought that was great. You know, it's, you could get under there and do your work yourself. And if a lot of the parts, you know, if you couldn't find a factory, you could almost, you know, if you had any mechanical ability, you could make a part for yourself. You know, that would fit and work. But and the driverless trains, I was watching. You know, I watch satellite feeds. Of course, I'm not watching it for really entertainment. I'm watching to see, you know, what the UN is doing around the world, you know, Agenda 2030 now. But I did see it was somewhere in the Middle East. I can't remember if it was Saudi Arabia or UAE or, you know, one of the countries that's not being, you know, pulverized into oblivion. They actually did have, they said it was a completely automated, you know, basically a subway system, an elevated train, you know, tram system in one of their cities like Mecca or Riyadh or somewhere. But they said it was completely autonomous, and it would, you know, you could go up there and just, you know, jump on your train, and it would drop you wherever you wanted to. And so I guess there are systems some, you know, around the world that are being put in. But I see a lot, you know, Saudi Arabia is heavy. They're proud of their, you know, agenda, you know, their Vision 2030, I believe is what they call it.
Yeah.
You know, for Saudi Arabia, and it's just Agenda 21. I see it, you know, in Kazakhstan, all these places. You know, Agenda 21 just coming in, and a lot of the places are proud of it, where the people really aren't aware of what's going on.
Yeah, and that's the whole goal, is a complete automated society.
Right, and
everything runs.
Those states like Kazakhstan, they were among the first, you know, where they were building this technology for the global tracking system, for weapons of mass destruction under Nunn Lugar. So.
Yeah, and that's it's a crazy world. It definitely is that.
Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw that in there, and I'll go ahead and drop off here and let your other callers get in.
Hey, appreciate it.
Good talking with y'all.
Hey, good talking with you. Thanks, Alan. I appreciate the call there. All right, let's go ahead and go to the next call. I'm not sure. Didn't have a chance to find out where this one was from, but we'll go ahead and take the call. Hello, caller. Who do we have here?
Yeah, this is Ken from West Virginia calling back. I just have a quick comment. You were talking about getting parts for your old car. Mercedes is now experimenting with using 3D printing. You know, they have some very valuable, you know, their old cars are very valuable, and people want to restore them. But that's the wave of the future.
Right.
Is that you'll be able to 3D print your part.
Yeah, you know, that's something that's really a fascinating area of technology that has just come out of nowhere, seemingly. And become a thing overnight. At least it seems like to the average commoner like me that it happened overnight. I mean, we never heard of 3D printing, and then all of a sudden, boom! Now all of a sudden, it's everywhere. And my question is, who designs these three-dimensional systems that you can plug into these computers and have it do all this? You know, I mean, it seems like you'd have to be a pretty technical person to be able to develop something like that.
You mean the printer itself or the device that you're designing?
The schematics that you have to plug in.
Yeah, you've got to be, I would think you've got to be kind of an engineer to start with.
Exactly. So, I mean, you'd almost have to find some kind of a thing online. That maybe that's what they'll end up starting to sell. Instead of your parts, they'll just sell the schematics that you plug into your 3D printing program, and that'll be the cost of the device. And aside from the raw materials that you need to put into your 3D printer, very odd society.
Yeah, you'll go down to a shop on your corner or something that has some guy that has a machine, and he'll print it out for you.
Yeah. It's a bizarre world.
Yeah, it is.
And you hit on something that really, we heard about this. It came in on the news, like on the Today Show one morning or something, about 4 years ago. And I'd never heard of it, and I'm sure you probably hadn't either. And it sprung upon us fully formed, you know. And some company had a patent on it, and they didn't want to divulge it. But, you know, I see where, like in... there's people have these machines that are doing all these things, and it was just like nobody knew about it. And like in China, they've got things that they build concrete houses with them and everything. So that just tells you the media, you know, all of a sudden there it is, fully formed, this 3D printing, you hit on something that really amazed me, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a bizarre situation. Well, listen, Ken, I appreciate the call, and thanks for calling back and giving us that additional input. I'm going to go ahead and move on and finish with this final hearing here. We had something in Congress right after the World Economic Forum took place, and this was a session that was back a while ago at the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Digital Commerce and Consumer Protection. They also held a hearing about the self-driving cars. Since we're on the subject, I think now would be a good time to plug that in. The chairman of the committee was Representative Bob Latta. He questioned Gil Pratt of Toyota Research Institute on how they plan to phase in the technology.
Mr. Pratt, in Toyota's comments to NHTSA on its federal automated vehicles policy, Toyota mentioned that it would be deploying automated driving systems in a step-by-step manner as the technology matures and becomes available. Would you walk us through what that step-by-step process looks like and how long you think it would take for that technology to mature to a point where it might be ready to be deployed?
Sure, I'd be glad to. First of all, we have a number of automated vehicle technologies that are already in our cars today. And these include the Toyota Safety Sense system and the Lexus Safety Sense system. In particular, automatic emergency braking is one of the types of this guardian system that I spoke about before, where the autonomy intervenes when the human is driving in order to prevent an accident. So that's already happening now, and we believe we're saving many lives as a result of doing so. Now, as you desire to have the human being take less and less control of driving and have the autonomy take over more control, you ascend up the SAE levels that you may know about. And our plan is to be self-timed in this regard. We don't have a specific date for when we're going to remove the driver from the car, very much like GM, but rather we are going to test and to see when the system is safe enough to do so. And of course, this doesn't happen all of the time. It happens at the beginning only some of the time in certain areas, certain weather, certain traffic conditions. At the beginning with human beings supervising the autonomy, and in the end where you can trust it enough so that you don't need a human being. So there's no definitive date for those steps, but a step-by-step process of gradually removing the amount of supervision that's necessary by the driver, eventually with the goal that no supervision is necessary, but checking each stage that the system is safe enough.
So next, Representative Frank Pallone questioned the panelists about the amount of involvement the drivers would have or should have during the phase-in. and the dangers of the drivers getting too comfortable with the technology that they let their guard down. Same type of thing that they kind of addressed in the World Economic Forum, but just in a little bit more in depth, I think.
Mr. Carberg, a large part of Volvo's brand has always been about safety. How does this impact what Volvo is doing before it puts a self-driving car on the street for testing and deployment?
Yeah, safety is clearly a priority throughout the whole development process for these cars. So we're targeting 2021 for this. And in order to make the safety to come at the right point, we are doing a number of different approaches when it comes to engineering. First of all, we will engage fully in major part into computer simulations. So we have a database of about 40,000 traffic accidents that has happened in the past with Volvo cars. We will take those, we will combine them with data from the US, data from Germany, and so that will be about 50,000 traffic accidents, which we will put into the computer, and we will ask the computer, how can you avoid this accident when you have AD technology? So that is one input when we go forward.
Okay, by the way, I wanted to jump in here and say I made a mistake. This guy, his name is Anders Carberg, and he's Vice President of Government Affairs at Volvo Car Group. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Moreover, you have to test this in public roads to learn about the behavior on how customers really interact with this.
Okay, did you hear that? You have to test it on public roads, what I've been saying all along. This technology is untested. I mean, they have this lab over at the University of Michigan where they're driving these things on a course or allowing them to drive, and they're testing them. But it's a closed system. And I understand a lot of these things are being driven or allowed to drive on, roadways in California and places like that. But you still don't have most of the cars on the highways and on the roadways that are self-driving or autonomous. So, anyway.
And so we will step by step introduce to these test these drivers more and more advanced technology. So we plan to be ready by 2021.
Well,
and I'd also like to point out how many potential accident situations have happened to you where you were able to take evasive action.
Yeah.
So they're using a database where there was an accident, leaving out all of the potential accidents that could have occurred, which is a far, far greater number.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is the one with Representative Frank Pallone questioning about, you know, the phase-in and the dangers of drivers getting too comfortable.
We've heard a concern about the period before cars are fully autonomous when there's still a driver, but that driver doesn't need to be active all the time. And even if the driver's in front of a steering wheel and trying to pay attention, if the car is doing most of the work, we know it's hard for the driver to stay engaged. And some have suggested that we could see an uptick in accidents with vehicles that are relying on drivers to re-engage in a split second. So let me start with Mr. Carberg. Volvo has said that it will skip level 3 automation, as I just described, and go from level 2 to level 4. Can you explain that decision, and is it due to the fears that I just mentioned?
Now, let me just jump in here real quick and explain a little bit what he's talking about with the levels. According to Reed Wright, these levels, I guess this is an industry standard, there are 5 levels that you need to know about. Level 0, of course, is no automation whatsoever. It's what we have right now for the most part. Level 1 is function-specific automation. You know, you had referenced earlier, Vicky, about cruise control. Level 1 involves only function-specific automation. The driver is responsible for safe driving, but can choose to limit authority to automated functions, cruise control, crash avoidance technology, or automatic braking. If several automated functions are provided, they operate independently. So that's level 1. Level 2 is combined function automation. Compared to level 1, level 2 provides automation of at least 2 control functions. In certain situations, the driver can decide to limit primary control, but will still need to be responsible for safe monitoring and take full control in short notice. Level 3 is limited self-driving automation. At this level, the driver can give up full control of functions that are safety critical in certain traffic or environmental conditions. The driver has to be available to take control, but is not expected to constantly monitor the driveway. The self-driving car is constructed to operate independently until the driver can take over. At level 4 is full automation. The driverless car is in full control of all operations and is responsible for safe driving the whole trip. The driver does not need to be available to take over control. While these are the levels of autonomy defined by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, other corporations such as SAE International does also strive to find a common terminology for automated driving, where their ranking goes from level 0 to level 5. So anyway, this is what he's talking about when he's referring to these different levels and skipping certain middle levels and going right to the end.
Oh, we pretty much agree with you. At level 3, the driver, the car is doing the driving. The car is doing the monitoring, but the driver is the fallback. So you could end up in situations where the driver has to take back the control, and that could happen within seconds. So we are concerned about the level 3 stage within SAE, and therefore we are targeting level 4 as the end game.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Calra, did you...
Each one of those steps is... It's like a development step in the technology.
Yeah.
And so just completely skipping over one step, which means they skip over the learning experience during that. I'd say that they're trying to rush their products to market.
That's exactly what they're trying to do.
Yeah, before they're stopped.
And there's a profit motive. Boy, that's a good point. I'd say you're probably right.
Yeah, because then Congress would have to deal with consumers that paid a lot of money for their vehicle. So, they're...
This is a can of worms. I mean, we're headed down a path that's going to be very, very, very... Well, interesting is not the word I want to use.
Dangerous.
Horrifying. Yeah. I mean, because... It won't be. I'm concerned. Now, I can't say I don't have a crystal ball. I can't say that it would be unsafe to be outside. It would be unsafe to be on the roads at all. But that's my concern, is that we're headed down a road where once this has been introduced, you know how technology is. Rolling it back would be next to impossible.
That's a very good point
you
made.
So we're going to be stuck with this. Yeah. Dangerous technology. Go ahead.
That's a good point that you just made. It's not just the people in the car. It's everybody else, too. It's pedestrians. It's animals.
You could be in your living room and the car be in your living room with you.
Yeah.
Because something went wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hope 20 years from now, we are able to look back and say, Weeks, you were wrong. Could happen. But I don't know. This is, like you said, they're rushing this thing. They are pushing this thing. Something that should, if we do it at all, which I don't think it's a good idea to do it at all. But if it's, obviously there are minds at work that have determined this is what we have to do as a society. And... So they're pushing it. But this is technology that should be years and decades even in the making. And it's being pushed hard for some reason.
The ultimate total police state.
Yeah.
That's what this is. That's what they're building. When you add up all these technology systems, across the board, it's absolute, total control.
Yep.
And people will have no autonomy whatsoever. They will just be, what do they call it, a Borg? You know, you will be controlled by the machines.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're seeing it everywhere.
Stage within SAE, and therefore we are targeting level 4 as the end game.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Kalra, did you want to comment on that?
I agree. There is evidence to suggest that level 3 may show an increase in traffic crashes, and so it is defensible and plausible for automakers to skip level 3. I don't think there's enough evidence to suggest that it should be prohibited at this time, but it does pose safety concerns that a lot of automakers are recognizing and trying to avoid.
All right, thanks. Let me go back to Mr. Carberg. Volvo has said that it will take complete liability at level 4. Can you explain that decision?
It is really not that strange. Car makers should take liability for any system in the car. So we have declared that if there is a malfunction to the AD system when operating autonomously, we would take the product liability.
Now, this is what we were talking about earlier. To move the technology along, they are willing to accept the responsibility, at least for now, to... you know, for accidents and things like that that would happen, the liability issues that would come up.
They have great lawyers, and what they do when you file a case is that they put the money aside, and then they fight you for long enough for the investment on the money set aside to pay the claim. So, you know, most people really can't afford attorneys anyway, so they're pretty safe doing that, actually.
Yeah,
because our legal system is all in favor of the business and not the victim.
Yeah, and that's a sad commentary. Mm-hmm. It really is a sad commentary, but that is how things work anymore. Individuals don't matter, corporations matter, shareholders matter, but individuals not so much, and certainly safety not so much.
Right, they're just human crash dummies.
Oh, boy. Final clip in this congressional thing and the whole self-driving car thing. They go on to address the possibility of cars getting hacked, and what are they going to do to mitigate the problem?
Now, researchers and investigators have demonstrated that the threat of a hacker assessing and controlling a connected car is real. In these reports, after vehicles have been accessed remotely, drivers are shown losing control of the horn, brakes, steering wheel, windshield wipers, and more. So I just wanted to ask, how real is the threat of vehicle hacking, especially in the autonomous context? And do you expect the nature of the threat to evolve as the technology develops?
Sure, I'd be happy to. It is a very real threat. Transportation is one of the areas that receives a lot of attention from hacking because it is a way to disrupt our transportation system. So there's a great concern there. And cybersecurity is not something that can sort of be shrink-wrapped on top of the vehicle because there's so many parts that contribute to the ultimate vehicle that it has to be baked in from the ground up. And it's not only hacking for fun and profit, but autonomous vehicles provide an avenue for terrorism as well, because there's a way to use these vehicles to, the threat is no longer sort of suicide bombers and that blow themselves up, but now we have vehicles that can drive around. So I don't want to overstate the risk at this time, but we need to think very broadly about cybersecurity, not only as a hacking opportunity, but also as a terrorism opportunity.
All right. Did you want to...
If I could add a comment.
Yeah, sure.
I completely agree with the point that because of the cybersecurity threat, as we contemplate self-driving vehicles, we need to design the vehicles from the ground up with that threat in mind. And certainly, in our case, as we deploy the self-driving Chevy Bolts, they look like the Bolts that we sell to retail customers, but we've gone very deep into the systems of the vehicle to make changes appropriate to ensure the cybersecurity in those vehicles.
Sure, go ahead.
And I wanted to add a little bit to that, too. So Toyota Connected is a subsidiary of our company that's primarily focused on this with Zach Hicks as the CEO. Toyota's presently the chair of the Auto ISAC that was described before for sharing information about cybersecurity threats. I think it's important that as serious to understand that as serious as this threat is, there are also mitigations that we can employ. And first of all is to make sure that the safety technology on the car does not depend on the wireless network in order to operate. So our philosophy is that all of the safety functions have to be self-sufficient on the car itself, and only information over the wireless network used to improve the efficiency of operation.
What do you think so far, Vicki?
Well, that's kind of what they did on the internet with software. You know, the there's a disclaimer that's, will you let us collect information on the performance of this software? And you say yes or no. Well, that doesn't preclude them from collecting data, other data, you know, that they may want to collect. It's kind of a courtesy thing, or, you know, a security blanket thing for you to feel good, but they can collect it if they want to. And anything that they develop, you know, where they say they're not going to collect information, you know they will. Yeah. I mean, that's it, period.
Yeah,
somebody will.
Yeah, and what got us down this road again is the weaponization of our highway systems. The piece that you wrote, which is up on thetechnocratictyranny.com, ladies and gentlemen, thetechnocratictyranny.com. Check it out. But we have the weaponization of everything going on today. And I come back again to the Aspen Institute and the forums that they've held recently. One of them was called Congress's Role in Making an Execution of National Security Policy in the Trump Era. This is a one that you were referring to a week ago. Now, the panelists were Michael McCaul, who is the chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, U.S. Representative for Texas's 10th Congressional District, Stephanie Murphy, who is a U.S. Representative for Florida's 7th Congressional District, Adam Schiff, ranking member of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and U.S. Representative for California's 28th Congressional District, Mac Thornberry, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, and Ryan Lizza, a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Now, they started off talking about the Trump campaign's meeting with the Russian attorney, which they can't seem to get away from. As we covered on previous broadcasts, this was likely a setup. They went around the table asking the panelists if they would have taken the meeting. Almost all of them said they would have reported it to the FBI, which I think is bullcrap. Because, look, if you're in a political campaign and somebody offers you dirt on your opponent, you're going to, I don't care what any of these characters say, they're lying. You're going to at least hear what the party has to say. And it's just the normal thing that people do in campaigns. So anyway, they claim that he's going to report them to the FBI and all this. Anyway, it was all about Russia, 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 how they influenced the election. They love to exploit our polarization.
What I worry about is goes back to the word you used in your question, and that is the drama. This is so much drama that occupies us. Meanwhile, as we heard earlier today, the Russians are modernizing their nukes. They have counter-space capability. They are developing new weapons. They're about to conduct big exercises in Belarus. Yeah. They are doing all of these things. And meanwhile, we're worried about the drama of who met who with whom.
Yeah.
Part of our job as an independent branch of government is keep our eye on the ball. In this case, the threats that Russia poses to the national security of the United States, and don't get so caught up in the drama that we lose sight of those things that Adam was just talking about and the broader Russian threat.
And isn't that part of the success of their campaign last year?
Yeah, and
is
we
that
fall
it
for
dominates
it.
Our
yeah,
conversations?
And we
right? In the old
it.
Days of the Soviet Union, they would exploit maybe our lack of full commitment to civil rights or yeah. support for dictatorships abroad. Now what they've discovered is one of our great weaknesses is our polarization, our partisanship. that if they can help one side against the other, it might be so tempting to take that help, and it throws the whole system, the whole conversation to chaos. We don't even get to the issues you're discussing.
No, and they exploit opportunities, and I think somebody earlier today, I forget, made that exact point. They're doing it very well, but again, to repeat myself, we see this, and yet we fall for it anyway. We better look at this broader picture, because as General Dumford and others said, this is at least the biggest threat to the national security of the United States.
Congressman Schiff, I want you to respond to this, because as someone who speaks a lot about this issue and the really micro details of what relationships the Russians and the Trump campaign may or may not have had, and is obviously on a committee running an investigation, is that a fair point? Do we spend too much time on this issue at the exclusion of other big ones?
You know, I don't think we spend too much time on it because, in particular, if there's any potential that the administration could be compromised, that's obviously a deep national security threat to the country. But I completely agree with Mac's point, which is we need to view this through the broader perspective of what Russia is doing. And what I always try to come back to when I talk about the investigation, why the investigation matters, the broadest perspective here, from my point of view, is we're engaged in a real ideological struggle with Russia right now. It isn't communism versus capitalism, but it is authoritarianism versus democracy and representative government. We see, looking at this objectively around the world, a real rise of the autocrats. Putin, I think, is in the vanguard of this, but you see it in Erdogan in Turkey and al-Sisi in Egypt and Duterte in the Philippines. You see it in Hungary and Poland. And there's a real challenge to the very idea of liberal democracy, an effort to tear down liberal democracy. What we saw in our elections, the Russians have been doing elsewhere.
Okay, now, everywhere they talk, there's no mention of the fact that the United States meddles in other countries' elections all the time.
Yeah, well, and technology enables dictatorship because it is total control. Mm-hmm. If you've got surveillance and tracking of your population 24/7, you can be a dictator. You can be an autocrat. And apparently, he doesn't know that whoever was speaking there. I think it was Thornberry, right?
Apparently,
he doesn't know about the BLM and the EPA, and their autocrats that come deal with the people out here. And another thing too, What he was talking about while Russia is modernizing their nukes and all of that, that was one of the significant things about Nunn-Lugar. We were paying to dispose of Russia's old technology while they were using their defense money to build new technology, and they talked about it at the time. At the time when they've debated Nunn-Lugar and reauthorizing money for it, and all during, you know, the few years after the collapse, our military people were over in Russia working with the Russian military. So we have a lot of people in our government that have close ties to the Russians. And one of them, interestingly enough, was Richard Armitage. Do you remember him from the Bush administration?
I remember the name.
He was the guy that looked kind of like the thug that didn't belong in a business office. anyway, he was
pretty much all of them to me, but go ahead.
Well, he worked in the for the Secretary of State, I think Condoleezza Rice.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the director of those programs working with the Russians.
Yeah. So, and you know, and here's the thing. All of this stuff about Russia, 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 Russia. And yet, one of the things that they had in this thing, in this meeting, was what I perceived to be just a bombshell revelation. Listen to this.
And we need to view this in the broader context of what the Russians are trying to do and the importance of our standing up and resisting that, working with our allies to resist Russian interference in their democracies, because this is the broader fight that I believe we're in.
It's all about destabilization. I got back from France after their election. They were clearly involved, but the French people didn't buy it because they knew it was Russia, talking about Macron. Yeah. Then I was in Estonia and Ukraine, heavy campaign disinformation warfare, in addition to kinetic warfare, annexing Crimea, being in eastern Ukraine. They tried to do it in our elections as well. I got the Gang of Eight briefing. I said at the time that we ought to call Russia out for what they're doing and that we have to have consequences to that.
Okay, now listen to this when he starts talking about consequences.
Legislatively, if you look at the Congress, we are working through a Russia sanctions package to punish Russia for both Crimea, but also their meddling in our elections.
Let me pause it right there. Of course, he referenced Crimea again. Crimea had a vote. They weren't just swallowed up by Russia. They voted and decided amongst the people that they wanted to be a part of Russia. So they never talk about that part. But regarding consequences, okay, and holding these countries accountable for the things they do.
Stop you there and tell us about the Gang of Eight briefing you're referring to and what the decision was that came out of that briefing by the administration.
Well, not to get into the classified space, but it was very clear.
The timing was what?
It was around the October timeframe before the election. It was not a gray, as Adam and Mac knows. This is not gray. It was black and white. Clear and convincing that this was on behalf of the Russian military and their intelligence apparatus. It was very shocking at the time. And I think part of the thinking at the time not to go public was because they didn't want it to appear to be influencing the elections or recognizing that Russia was doing this because it would embolden and empower them. Since that time, though, I think it's imperative that Congress act on the sanctions bill.
Wait, but I just wanted to keep on this subject. The way that this has been reported publicly is that the Obama administration wanted to do more in public, and the resistance came because of this partisanship we're talking about, that McConnell and some Republicans said, no, wait a second, don't do that. That could tip the election towards Hillary Clinton, and we would consider that interfering with the election. Is that your understanding of how that happened?
And well, the rest of you can speak on it. It was in a classified setting, so I can just tell you from my perspective what I said, and that was we should call them out very clearly, because it wasn't kind of an iffy gray area, and I haven't seen real consequence in the whole cyber arena too.
Yeah,
what was the consequence to China stealing 20 million security clearances? You know, I was in Tom Bossert's office in the Situation Room talking about what can we do in the future to stop that kind of bad behavior from North Korea, from Iran, from China and Russia.
Okay, did you hear that, what he said? China stole 20 million security clearances?
Hey, I have an idea. How about Cyber Command? How about an addition to the Unified Command Plan? And we'll have a new domain, and it's called cyberspace.
Yeah.
And then they will have total information control, total domain awareness over the whole damn world.
That's exactly what they want. Gee,
yes.
you could be one of them. You could go to work for them.
Because it wasn't kind of...
You know, but this is the thing that really bothers me right here. Okay.
And I haven't seen real consequence in the whole cyber arena, too.
Yeah.
What was the consequence to China stealing 20 million security clearances?
Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't.
China stole 20 million security clearances.
But now, I heard recently...
20 million, somebody, Vicky. 20 million.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a lot of security clearances. Why haven't we been hearing about this in the news?
Well, I'm wondering, what did they steal? A security card? Because you
I'm assuming he's referring to the OPM database hack. Remember the Office of Personnel Management?
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking that's what he's talking about here. And I'm wondering when they established that it was actually China doing this. Why haven't we slapped sanctions on Beijing? Seems that stealing all of our intelligence information and every single CIA agent and where they're stationed and all every security contractor, wouldn't that be like more important than just, oh, I don't know, just the stupid U.S. elections? I mean, we're talking about real national security issues here. And hey, it's all quiet. You never hear anything about it.
Everything they say is a contradiction. If you think about it logically, and if you remember what happened, you know, a few days before or a week before, everything that they say is a contradiction. Yeah. So they're all just lying, you know. We are living in the most, in the biggest, most massive lie that in the history of the world.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. Unbelievable that this big, giant, massive smokescreen is going on, and yet real, genuine world, real-world security issues are just being completely ignored. Completely yeah. ignored. Well, we can't ignore the fact that the clock on the wall is telling us it's time to go.
It's a tyranny.
It is. It is a technocratic tyranny. All right, thanks for being with us, and thank you, Vicki. God bless you, folks. Thanks, everybody, for listening and spreading the word about the broadcast. We'll be here again next week, Lord willing, same time, same outlet. In the meantime, pray for this republic, do what you can to restore it, and God bless you, folks. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.